We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Well, so very pleased to have here back again on the program David Sinnott. He is clinical professor of finance in the U of I in the College of Business. He's here once a month, and we do these shows on financial planning. And he usually has a few things to say about the economy and then answers questions. Excuse me. And this time around, we're going to take both hours of the show, so lots of time to answer questions. And we have a special guest Dave has brought along. And the idea here is that we want to give folks an opportunity to ask questions about mortgages. Maybe people want to buy a house and they're not really quite sure how to go about the business of borrowing the money. And maybe they even have some concerns about, you know, what's the mortgage market like these days, and would they have any difficulty? So we have special guest. Dave, you want to introduce him?
Well, of course. And good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. With us this morning is Mark Jakowski. Mark is a mortgage consultant with Wintrust Mortgage in Champaign, and he's here to share some of his expertise on all the kinds of questions that you could possibly imagine about procuring mortgage financing. And Mark, very interestingly, is not a neophyte in this business, having been in the mortgage business about 17 to 18 years. Previous to that, a very prominent career in the real estate area, and most importantly, David, an alumni in radio and TV from the University of Illinois, but apparently the Campbell Center was not here back when, well, I won't tell you when he went to school, but he is younger than I am. So, but he remembers that there was probably, what, a barn here, Mark?
Pretty much.
Pretty much a barn and not this gorgeous edifice, which is obviously been possible as a result of all of the wonderful listeners and the amazing philanthropy of the Campbell family, et cetera. And I would just like to re-echo from my vantage points that it is indeed just, well, it's a pleasure, as I say, to be here with you, to have the opportunity to visit with all of our friends at WILL. And, of course, I urge them to make contributions so you can continue the tremendous work that you and all of the folks at WILL do. It's just an amazing station. I know when I travel across the country and with my wife, Carol, and sometimes we're going to the north, sometimes we're going to the east, and we always look for good radio, and it's just very, very difficult once we leave the area. And the other public radio stations that we do listen to, they just can't match. It's true. This is just an extraordinary place filled with extraordinary people, and I know it's an expensive business to maintain. So I can well understand your desire to urge our listeners, as well as I do, to please contribute so this wonderful, wonderful station can continue. Yeah. Okay. Enough of the commercial, I think. So let's talk about mortgages. And Mark and I have a number of areas that we would like to discuss. But obviously, if we have people calling in, Mark is here, I'm here, and I think, Mark, you probably can answer most of those questions. Yeah. So I know one of the things that we've talked about off the air is the importance of credit and credit scores. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about that and how that funnels into this whole mortgage financing business.
Well, Mark, credit scores credit scores are very, very important in our industry, especially in the last two or three years. What the credit scores do are indicate to our lenders the likelihood of that borrower paying his mortgage on time. There's computer programs that they have. There are three different companies. One's called Equifax, one's called Experian, and one's called TransUnion. All the information on you goes to those three credit bureaus. They put that information into their computers, and each one of them comes up with a number for you. And if your wife, she would have three also. In regards to that, the lender takes the middle of the three scores. So if you had a 680 and a 700 and a 720, they'd use 700 as your score. In the past year, things have changed dramatically. It used to be that if you had a credit score of 680, you were considered an excellent borrower. and you would get the best rates, best terms, et cetera. Since this subprime mess that we've been in and all the foreclosures and things, they've raised that score significantly. Now the credit score is 740, which is significant. So all those people between 680 and 740 that were excellent last year are now not excellent. And there must be, I'm assuming on the computer, there must be enough risk between 680 and 740 to make that that change. Now, I should mention to you what these numbers mean. First off, the credit scores start at 300 and go up to 850. Now, as I said, 740 and above is considered excellent. You can get a loan so long as your middle credit score is 620 or above. It used to be you can go down to 580, but now FHA is you can go down to 620. Some lenders actually, Dave, have started going up to 640, and one lender I know is going up to 660. That shows you how scared the lenders are about people's ability to pay.
Okay, so the bottom line is that first you better understand your credit score and probably check it out ahead of time before you even start to think about obtaining a refinance or new financing.
Absolutely, and that's the thing that most people are aware of. But the one thing I want to point out about that is there are different types of credit scores. If you're going in just to get a credit card or something of small value, you can get a credit score totally different than if you will go to get a mortgage, because the mortgage is probably the most the hardest one to get, and they're more specific on that and more detailed on that. And the score getting that you might get from me might be totally different if you're going in to buy a stereo or something. So there are different credit scores, and I was not aware of that until about a year ago, that there are the credit scores that you get is not necessarily what you'll get with me.
Okay.
So you have to be sure that when you're pulling up a mortgage credit score, it's much more intensive than it would be just getting something of smaller value.
Now, if I'm out shopping for a house, for example, does it make sense before I start making offers on a house to see a mortgage lender, a mortgage consultant, and get what's called pre-qualified? I've heard that there's this pre-qualification opportunity.
Absolutely. In fact, a lot of realtors will not even show you a house unless you
really?
Have a, unless you have a pre-approval letter from a lender. The simple reason is there's no sense in wasting their time showing you a house that you may not be able to afford. And part of that process is obviously pulling up your credit. That is right now probably the number one issue. If you have a credit score above 740, then you're in pretty good shape. The next thing, of course, would be what your income is and what your debts are and that type of thing.
So if I make an appointment to come in for pre-qualification, do I need to bring some things with me, or do I just simply sign and instantaneously can you run my credit?
Yes, I can run your credit with your authorization, of course.
Run it without it.
Can't run it without it. But, yes, you have to get authorization to pull up your credit report, and I can pull it up right then and there. Now, there will be things that you'll need to bring to the appointment. Obviously, the normal type things. If you're W-2 type income, you would need your last 2 years W-2s. If you're self-employed or commissioned, you would need to bring your last 2 years complete tax returns. You would also need to bring things, Dave, like your last 30 days pay stubs, your last 2 months complete bank statements from your checking and savings accounts. You would need to bring your most recent 401k or IRA or money market statements, complete statements. Probably also a copy of your driver's license would be required. So those are the type of things that you would normally have. If you've been divorced, you would need divorce papers, obviously. If you are on Social Security or things like that, you would need to bring things like your Social Security or pension or whatever else.
Okay, so let me ask this. How long does this all take in terms of – is this an hour appointment, hour and a half? How long
– Usually it's about an hour, hour and a half, depending upon how many questions you have, depending upon what kind of employment you have. A lot of times it'll go closer to an hour and a half because there's some things that don't quite add up or things that are going to be an issue one way or another.
Let's say I'm pretty clean. I have W-2 income. I bring in my statements, et cetera. I have a fairly decent credit score. And then I get pre-approved? Is that it?
Yes. What we do is we basically enter all the information in a computer.
Okay.
And basically all the information, once it's entered, then we do what's called a DU or LP. And that basically is a computer program that will instantaneously look at all the information we inputted about your income, about your assets, your debts, your credit score, all those types of things, and your ratios. And then what it'll do is say, yes, you've been approved, subject to the following, verifying the following things, verifying that you are, in fact, still working, verifying that you're making what you say you're making, verifying that you have the funds to close, you know, all those types of things. But it's almost instantaneous, and then you can get a, you know.
So when I walk out the door, assuming that what I've told you is actually true, then I walk out the door with a pre-qualification letter.
Correct.
Subject to contingencies.
A lot of contingencies,
okay.
Usually. But yes.
Understood. Will that tell me, for example, I'm approved for $100,000 of mortgage financing, $500,000, a nickel? What does it tell me?
Basically, you kind of give me from the very beginning what price range you're looking for. Price area you're looking at. Now, say, for example, you're looking for $150,000, and that's what you feel comfortable at, and I can tell you what your payment might be. And if you feel comfortable with that, that's what I put in there. Now, it's all based on what your ratios are. In other words, what your income is compared to what your debt ratio is. For example, if you are putting down 20%, basically your ratio can go up to 45%, meaning that 45% of your gross monthly income can go towards your house payment, which would include taxes and insurance plus any other debts. So by doing that, if you're below 45%, you're going to be fine. You can get approved for what up to that level if you want.
Of course, that's a massive amount of debt compared to income for someone to spend 45%.
Right.
That seems very, very liberal to me and not very conservative. And I couldn't in good faith suggest that someone should take 45% of their gross income.
No, I don't either.
But interestingly enough, you can get pre-qualified under the governmental rules based upon that.
Yes, so long as you have put down 20%.
Got it.
To have enough money into it to make it not as much of a – and, of course, a credit score 740 or above.
Understood.
So there's a lot of criteria go into it. But obviously, as that goes – their credit score goes down and your down payment goes down, so go the ratios, so go everything else. Now, that's maximum. And, again, I'm like you. I don't recommend going that unless you have substantial –
Assets
that you can cover and it's not a problem. But
sure.
Most people don't go quite that high.
Understood.
We have a caller. Why don't we do that? And let me again real quickly introduce again our guest. This is Focus 580, our monthly show on financial planning. My name is David Inge, and here in the studio with me is David Sinnoh. He is here on the program once a month with us to do these shows. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. And this month he's brought along as a special guest, Mark Jukowski. He is a guy who's been for quite a long time now in the mortgage business. For the past 18 years, he's been a mortgage consultant. He works with Wind Trust Mortgage, that's in Champaign. And before that, he spent 17 years as a realtor. And I think Dave's thought was that we might have folks who would like to ask questions about what's involved in getting a mortgage. So any questions that you might want to ask, you should pick up the telephone and give us the call. It's the same number as always for the show here. No one's going to expect you to make a pledge. We'd like that, but that's not required to call in. 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Due to a rapidly changing domestic situation, shall we say, I'm relocating from the area to the Wausau, Wisconsin area. And unfortunately, I've been unemployed around here since July, but I have no doubt I can get work there, say, starting November 1st and so forth. I'm wondering if you'd give me a thumbnail sketch on how long I would have to be employed, so on and so forth, before I would even be considered for a mortgage. I have a house here that I'll be renting that I have 70% equity in, so forth. I have that asset. And I can probably count on an income of $45,000 to $50,000 a year once I get going up there. How long would it take me for how long would it the time be for a bank to consider, generally speaking, being conservative, consider me for a mortgage and so forth?
Typically, they'll want to see a two-year history. However, if you're in the same field that you're in now, and once you've been working for a full year and you've got a history of working in that profession for quite a while, they'll look favorably upon that. Now, some lenders are becoming more strict and will say 2 years, period. Some lenders have common sense. And realize if you've been a doctor for 40 years and you're not a doctor for 6 or 8 months and you're starting as a doctor again, they have some common sense, and once you've been on that job for a year, they'll say, "Well, you know, more than likely you're going to stay here. You've got the skills, obviously, to handle the job." Then, more than likely, they'll say yes.
But yeah, I have 20 years' experience in my field, so
right. So I would say that probably a year. And who knows what'll happen next year? But I would say a year would probably be the minimum.
Would it help too? The more you say, the properties up prices up there now are pretty good. And mm-hmm. just an example, if I can put 20% down on a $100,000 house, with that plus the equity I have in the rental property I'll be leaving here in Illinois, will that help me favorably as well? Or
you betcha. They're looking for as many positives as they can, and those things include obviously stability of your income. They're looking for low debts. They're looking for down payment so that they don't have a risk. If you put down 50% on that house, they don't have much of a risk.
Right.
If you're putting down 5%, yes, they do have a big risk. So they're going to be more lenient to somebody who has, you know, $100,000 or $500,000 in a savings account or a 401k, and you're putting down 50%, and you've got a credit score of 780, and you've been working on your job for 20 years except for the last 6 months. So, yeah, absolutely all those things go into play. Not one in particular is going to, you know, put it over the top, but they look at anything they can that would make it easier for them to make an approval for you.
Yeah, sounds like about a year then. And,
I would say so, just, you know, in general terms, and every situation may be different, and every lender is different. But for the most part, I'd say so, yes.
Because I would very much like to be able to borrow, you know, get a mortgage on the house I'm going to reside in outright, and then sell the property I have here. Mm-hmm. And take the proceeds from that, and as much as they will let me also then leverage that up and put that into several rental properties in the area where I'm living.
Well, it sounds like you have a plan, and but it sounds also like about a 1 year before you're going to start that plan.
Right. And one thing to be remembered, too, in regards to your property that you're going to rent, that's something you need to also be aware of. Right now, and until you have it on your tax return, they're going to count that as a debt. The taxes, the insurance, the principal and interest, that is going to be a debt. So if your house payment is $1,000 a month, that is a debt because you do owe that.
And the only debt I have on this property is the home equity line of credit I have on it.
But you also have taxes and insurance.
Right.
And so 1/12 of that, 1/12 the taxes, 1/12 the insurance, and then whatever that is, that would be included in your debt ratio. So if so long as you have a good debt ratio, you're going to be fine. Now, once you get that property rented and it is on your tax returns, verifiably on the tax returns, then you take basically 75% of the rental amount to offset that payment, and that would be either an income of a couple hundred dollars or a debt of $20 or something. So once you've put it on your tax return, then that income property that you have can be an asset.
Right.
But in the meantime, now it would be a liability.
All the income from the rental property is going right into paying down the home equity line and so forth. And okay, sounds like I got a year. All right, thank you very much.
All right,
good luck.
Let's talk with somebody in Des Plaines. That's up in the Chicago area. Here, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. My wife and I, we may sell our home. And when we get around to doing that, the question is, being that we're both retired, would we be able to get a mortgage, assuming that we, at that point we'd have savings and pension, Social Security, and the equity from the home? But would we be able to get a mortgage, or is a job required to get a mortgage?
That's a great question. Go ahead, Mark.
No, Social Security is income. As long as it's going to continue for 3 years, pensions, as long as they're going to continue for 3 years, that's income. I mean, that's stable income. You can be retired and live off Social Security and buy a house without question and get a 30-year mortgage. You may be 80 years old or 90. You can still get a 30-year mortgage if you want. You can – whatever your income is, you don't have to have a job.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, that's what I was thinking, maybe the assets that we have.
That would be helpful,
yeah,
certainly, and that would have to do with your down payment and, and your loan amount. But the key thing to remember there is that you have to qualify for the loan amount based on what your income is.
You know, it would be sensible to pre-qualify.
Yes, without question, because your Social Security, if it's more than Social Security, I assume, anything that is 3 years or longer in duration that you're taking out, pensions, 401ks or whatever, those would count too. We just have to verify it. But that is certainly income, and it's substantial income that they would count.
And if you're fortunate enough to combine Social Security, pension, and interest on investments, that should be enough for them to make a decision.
Yeah, absolutely. As long as you have a 740 credit score.
Oh, well, all right. Okay.
That would be very helpful.
Yeah, sure, I agree. I think we should have some standards. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We're just about the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580. Both hours of the show today will be taking questions on financial planning. That's something that we do on this show every month, always on Friday, with this one of these guys here who's with me, Dave Sinno. He's a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. We've been doing those shows for a long time because we all knew that people would always have these questions. So we try to provide this as a resource. You know, one of the things I think I always say is, well, don't just do something because Dave says to do it, but use this as part of your research. And, of course, we hope that before you make important financial decisions, you will do research and seek out many different sources of information and do your best to understand what you're doing, understand what the risks are, and then, you know, go on from there. And this is just one, should be one stop in that process.
Well, David, if you told me to do something, I would do it, David.
Okay. In that case, I think you should pull out your checkbook and write a big check to the friends of WILL. See, you thought it was going to be... No, I don't want you to write that check to me. And that's what we want people who are listening this morning to do, to make a contribution to WILL. And it can be, you know, you decide the amount. I think the important thing is that everybody could make a contribution. You know, so maybe for you, $40 would be good, or maybe you could do $75, or maybe you could do $120. I mean, you know, that's really up to you. What you're doing, though, when you make that contribution is you're helping to keep this station strong so we can keep bringing you the programming that you enjoy. Martha Deal is here in the studio. Martha Deal is here in studio with me. She's one of our producers. I don't know what's going on there. Maybe you had a little transmitter issue. We're also having a little microphone
issue. Sorry about that, everyone out there. We don't like to put stuff like that out on the air, and your dollars actually do help prevent us from doing that. You know, America is a land of great ideas, and you're listening to one right now. Actually, you're listening to two. One, you're listening to public radio, and two, you're listening to David and Mark give you really good advice about what to do and what not to do. And we enjoy being able to bring you that kind of programming. But we need your support. You know, we don't get the big advertising bucks like the used-to-be major networks. I guess we still have some of those. We, you know, about one-third of our money, 40% of our money comes from you, the listeners. And we want to thank the 50 people who've called in this morning. Today we've raised $5,315, and 15 of those were ag people. I'm sure some of you are still listening to David to find out what to do. So pick up your phone, call 217-244-9455 with your pledge, or go online to willpledge.org. And as David said, how much you give is up to you. David?
All right. What I want to do is, again, urge people to make their contribution. You can do it easily by calling 217-244-9455. You can do it online if you like, and I think more and more people are choosing to do it that way. So that's Will Pledge. That's just like it sounds, W-I-L-L, Pledge, willpledge.org. Make your pledge that way. Either way, it's a great investment in quality programming here on WILL Radio. Again, guests in this part of Focus 580, David Sinno from the College of Business here at the U of I, and also has a special guest, Mark Jagowski. He's a mortgage consultant, has been for the past 18 years. He works with Wintrust Mortgage in Champaign, and before that, he spent 17 years as a realtor. And Dave's idea was to open things up here and say, well, maybe you have some questions about all of the things that are involved in getting a mortgage. Now's the opportunity to call in. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have some callers here who have been patient, and we'll get right back to them. The next is in Champaign, line two, right here. Hello. Yes.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
It's a good show today. I'm enjoying this.
Good.
My question is about real estate as an investment. The prices are good now, and I've been seriously considering buying a small house in a small town and using that as rental property. My question is, I'm wondering if there's some sort of a rule of thumb, like, you know, you're going to ask this much rent. Obviously, you have to research how much rent you could get in a small town in a small house. This much rent from a renter compared to the mortgage payment that you would make, and then factoring in how much money you may have put in as a down payment, how much money you might have to be holding on the side for things like if you need to replace the furnace all of a sudden or something like that in the rental property. Is there some sort of a formula that people go by for something like that?
Well, I'm not certain that there is a precise formula, and I'm going to jump in for just a moment, and then, Mark, you jump in also. I think you need to really do your homework and do a lot of research. And I'm caught that you were thinking of buying some rental property in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
I would be very careful about that. I'm not sure your definition of a small town, but in any event, I would want to be in a small town that is surrounded by a larger metropolitan area. So
yeah.
There are certainly areas in a small metropolitan area like Champaign-Urbana. There are some communities around Champaign-Urbana, which are almost like suburban communities. And that's what you're talking about, right.
Yeah, exactly.
But to go out and buy in an area where there are 250 to 500 population, where that population is actually decreasing, I don't think you're going to see much appreciation in homes. But something very, very close to a tertiary market like Champaign-Urbana does make sense.
Okay.
Obviously, you have to do a lot of homework, and a lot of that, depending upon the area, I think that it would make sense to get involved really with a professional. It might be a real estate agent who really understands that particular market. I would want to work, as I say, whenever I'm involved in a real estate project, I want to work with a professional who dominates that market, who lives, breathes, and understands that market, someone who can really help me make those kinds of decisions. Also, I think if you haven't been in the rental property business, you want to sit down with your accountant to understand how the tax implications work on rental property. In other words, really, you get income from rent, and then you get to subtract your expenses, which are, of course, real estate taxes, insurance, maintenance, and interest on your mortgage. And then finally, there is a non-cash expense called depreciation, which you also receive. So very, very typically in a rental property, you might have $10,000 of income, $8,000 or $9,000 of expenses, and then maybe $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 of depreciation, so you actually generate a tax loss on the property. So you may get some advantages from a tax loss on the property, while at the same time building equity, because each month that mortgage payment is being paid off. So you want to keep that in mind. Another rule of thumb that I typically have is I hate to get involved in properties that have a negative cash flow. In other words, if I put down a typical down payment in a rental property, which often today, Mark, is 25 or 30%.
30%.
Sure. All right, if I put down 30% of my hard-earned money and I go out and buy a $100,000 home, I don't want to get into a situation that every month I have a negative cash flow. In other words, my rent isn't enough to cover all of my expenses. I don't think that makes a lot of sense, especially if this is going to be my first rental property. I'm probably going to manage it, which means I'm going to have all of the aggravation with it. So I want to make certain that I would have a positive cash flow. And again, a professional consultant can help you with that. I think that's very important with a rental property, is not to get involved in it if you have a negative cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
Does any of that help you?
Yes, that was exactly what I needed to hear. I didn't know the stuff about the taxes and the depreciation, so I'll look more into that.
Absolutely. Mark, did you want to say anything else about that?
Just to say that right now that the 30% down payment, it used to be 20%, and there was a time where you could actually put down 10%, and there was one program, believe it or not, that was 100%. That is kind of why the country is in the shape it is now, is because of those type of programs. But obviously the lenders have all become very, very conservative. There are some lenders that are not even making loans for investment properties, period. But the ones that are putting down requiring 30%, you have to have good credit, you have to have reserves. And what I mean by that is you have to have 6 months' worth of your house payment in a savings account or checking account or something like that in reserve for that very reason. If you have any maintenance problems, if the roof, you get a hole in the roof, or you have to replace the siding or the furnace or hot water heater, they want to see 6 months worth of reserves. So and especially if you've never done this before, they're going to be very critical, and they're going to look at it very, very closely to make sure that everything adds up. So they're going to be very conservative.
And one other point I want to make certain is that it pays to do due diligence, which means that if you even make an offer on a property, make sure that that offer is conditional on a property inspection from a licensed property individual who is in that inspection business, and that that inspection is approved or disapproved in your judgment, so that you have a way out of that contract. It is conditional, one, on that inspection that you approve, and two, it obviously is conditional on mortgage financing if you're not going to pay cash for the property. So those are two very important conditions that you've got to have in any real estate contract.
Great.
All right?
Well, you guys, that was great. I learned all kinds of stuff there.
All right.
Okay, good.
Well,
okay,
thank you. Thank you. Very good. We'll go to Leroy for another caller here, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I have a mortgage, but my question is about escrow. I recently received a notice from my mortgage company saying that the escrow was short $680, and therefore they wanted to increase my payment from $1,100 a month to $1,220 a month. And I'm wondering, can I just go in and give them the $680 and say we're even and leave my payment at $1,100? How does this work?
Your best bet, I would certainly talk to them. What happens, why you're paying more simply is that there's a shortage from the previous year. Obviously, they paid it. So what they're doing now is raising your payment to cover the previous deficiency from the previous year. Plus, guess what? Your taxes are higher, or homeowner's insurance is higher this year, so they got to add that on top of it too. So now,
right.
So they're basically they're doing that. They do it once a year. They do what's called an escrow audit, and they check to see where you're at. And unfortunately, for us, usually there's one thing that usually goes up, and that's our taxes.
That.
And unfortunately, we don't have much recourse on that. But the lender doesn't care. I mean, they've got to make sure things add up. So consequently, they're going to do that. Now, you can call. I would suggest you call your lender. I'm not sure they will do anything, but it never hurts to talk to them, because different lenders have different policies, and it never hurts to talk to them. If you don't escrow, of course, you wouldn't have that problem.
Right.
But escrowing, you do. It is, unfortunately, one of the negative things about escrowing is that your payments can go up because of other things going up. And typically it's your real estate taxes. Sometimes it's your homeowner's insurance. But that is something that I know is a problem. And when I counsel with people, when we talk about putting down payments, that's one of the things I say. If you put down 20%, this is one issue you would not have. But if you're above 80% or you've decided to escrow, these are the things that you run into. And it's unfortunate, and you don't usually budget for it, but you can't control what real estate taxes do. They go up typically, and every year they do, and your payment could go up. So that's going to continually happen. Some lenders, not many that I know of, but some lenders will allow you to make up for the deficiency and lower your payment. But you'll have to talk to them one-on-one and find out what that company will do.
Okay. Is there a reason why I would be going up twice as much as what I owe? Because that's basically
whatever your deficiency was from the previous year and what it is now is what it all comes down to, is dollars and cents, and that's it.
And, Mark, you can request that escrow audit, can you not? Can't you request that information on what that's based on?
Yes, you can, certainly, and they have to give that to you. And it, typically, they do it just about this time of the year. Usually in September, October, November is when you find most of the lenders will do their escrow audit because they have just paid the second installment of your taxes normally, and that's where they'll find out very quickly if the taxes, if they have enough in the escrow account to pay for it or not. Now, when you first bought the house, my guess, I mean, not guess, but I'm sure that at that time, they, when they started your escrow account, they put in 2 extra months worth of taxes into your into the kitty. In other words, if your taxes were $200 a month, when you first start that escrow account, they put in an extra $400 into your account to start it off for that very reason, because they know that real estate taxes generally go up. Well,
right.
That may have been 10 years ago or 5 years ago, and that may have already been used up. So that's why you, your taxes apparently went up, and that's the situation.
Well, this is almost an annual thing that it,
yes.
that it happens this way.
Every year they do an escrow escrow audit, and it's usually this time of the year.
Yeah, but the only reason I had a real question about it is I expect it to go up. I know that. I know
right.
taxes are going up. I know insurance is going up. But I don't understand why if I owe $680, they want to raise it $120 a month. That's my dilemma.
And that's why you need to contact them and go over the escrow audit.
Right.
Okay.
Hey, guys, I really appreciate your help.
One,
you.
One quick question. Is
yes.
it Leroy or Leroy?
It's Leroy.
Leroy. Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Well, and now here, let me ask a quick question because and this is the case with my mortgage and I assume others. You have the opportunity, excuse me, in addition to paying your payment every month, you can pay addition on your principal. You can pay addition on your escrow. And if you figure it's going to, I mean, I've had the same experience as the caller for several years now. And I get, maybe I'm fortunate, my lender offers the choice. They mm-hmm. say, here's what you owe. You want to write us a check? Cool. If not, we're going to increase your payment. And I've been fortunate. It hasn't been a whole lot of money. It seems to me, well, that's a no-brainer. I'm going to write you the check. I don't want you to increase my payment. But I suppose I could have been paying a little extra as I'm going along, provided, of course, that you can. Mm-hmm. And that would tend to that would be one way to – would you recommend that people do that?
You have a coupon, I'm
right,
assuming,
right,
every, each
right,
month.
Yeah.
And on that coupon, it does have a spot there for additional principal. And also additional escrow.
Right.
If you put the money in the escrow account, that's fine, and you won't have any, you know, the increases. But what that means is they're using your money, and you're getting no interest for it. That's the one nice thing about – I mean, the bad thing for you is they've got your money. And believe me, across the country, all these banks, all these escrow accounts, they're using your money, and they're paying you nothing for that.
And it's highly lucrative for banks.
And they're making money.
Absolutely.
Billion. I mean, they're making billions of dollars off your escrow account. So, yeah, if you want to do that, that's fine. You're giving them money to use and let them make interest off of it. Now, on the principal, I'm a strong believer if you pay additional principal, it's terrific.
Yeah.
What you're basically doing is by paying additional principal on your coupon, you just fill that in and, of course, pay it. What that does is, you know, it's – if you make one extra payment a year, principal payment, principal interest payment a year, you are effectively knocking your 30-year mortgage down to 22, 23 years. Now, it depends on the loan amount, how much, but that's a huge difference. Think about that for a minute. Mm-hmm. If you make one additional payment a year, let's say your payment's $500 a month, make an additional $500 a month, $500 a year, $40 or
yeah,
so,
$42.50
a month.
Yeah,
by making an additional $42.50 a month, you're not making a payment for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. Not making a payment for 7 years for $42 a month.
Okay.
And interestingly enough,
that's huge.
Yes, absolutely. And interestingly enough, when you procure a mortgage, the mortgage document always enables you to pay additional principal without penalty.
Yeah. And so, okay, so, and I want to get some other calls here, but then just to the answer to my question is actually better to take that money and stick it aside than to give it to the bank every month. And
yeah.
then when it rolls around, then
right.
they say, okay, you owe extra money. You say, okay,
I
got
is.
It. Here
yeah.
it is.
Exactly. So, of course, the key thing is there, you're going to make 1% to 2% on that money.
Yeah. All right. We got several callers here. We'll try to get as many in as we can in this hour. And then we will be here for, again, the second hour doing some of the same kind of stuff. So if you don't get in this hour and you can, we'll take your call in the next. So we will talk next with someone in, I believe, in Champaign in line 3. How about that? Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't realize line 3 came up so quickly. Actually, I had one initial question, but, you know, you started with the conversation, so now I have two. You were talking about the 42%, you know, that for debt. That, in terms of your total income, right? Was that the idea?
Based on gross income. Gross, it's not income. Net taxable income. It's gross income, and the number was 45%.
45.
But that's a heavy number.
Oh, yeah, but that was also for that's the amount of payment that you can make in a year. Is that the idea?
Well, the 45%, Mark, is really taxes, insurance.
Right. So let's say, for example, in simple terms, because I'm simple, if you made $1,000 a month, mm-hmm. gross, they don't want you spending any more than $450 a month for your house payment, which includes taxes and insurance, plus any other monthly debts, car payments, Visa, MasterCard, anything else. So that's the maximum that they'd want. And that's based on you putting down 20% and having an excellent credit score. If you don't have 740 credit score and you don't put down 20%, then they're talking closer to 41%.
What's the national average on that one?
Well, I don't know what the national average is, but I can tell you this. These figures, these percentages, they have done research on for 50 years. They researched and find out why people are being foreclosed on. Now, this is before this last year, but basically why, you know, what type of income can a family or a person handle easily enough where they can make their payments and not be under duress. And they've done research and research and research. So these numbers aren't just out of the clear blue. They've been done for years and years.
And let me jump in there that originally the rules were quite a bit more stringent when yes. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac originally came out. The original rules were 28% of your gross income. That was the max that you could spend for your mortgage payment, taxes, and insurance. And then you add in all of your other long-term debts, your car payments, your student loan payments, your credit card payments, and that total could not exceed 36% of your gross income. Those are the old days that Mark and I remember. And if they had stuck to those rules, the 28-36% Fannie Mae guidelines, the subprime mortgage crisis and all of the mortgage defaults, which are accelerating this calendar quarter, that would not have happened. Right. Simply would not have happened.
So then we could have referred to that actually it was the good old days.
Those were.
I have another question. If you pay, I think I was told when I took the loan a while back that if I paid earlier, that actually there is an amount of savings. In other words, let's say my mortgage is due the first of the month. If I paid so many days before that, would that actually, in terms of the calculation, I mean, it might be minor, but it's...
Actually, no, it really doesn't, because it's based really on a 12-month amortization schedule, 360 payments, for example, for 30 years. If you have a commercial mortgage where interest is figured on a daily basis, then it makes a difference. But in a typical residential mortgage, if you pay in the first of the month, the fifth of the month, and certainly before the 15th, when you then get penalized, it's not going to impact you. The only time it impacts you is when you go to pay off the mortgage. Mm-hmm. And then that particular month when you pay it off is figured on a per diem, a per interest day. If you pay on the first, obviously you're going to pay less interest on that payoff than if you pay on the 7th or the 8th or the 10th.
Okay.
And all one right. other thing I might want to add, too, and this I ran across a couple years ago. I had a lady who wanted to pay her payment a week before, thinking that she was ahead of the game. She was at a local bank, and the payment was due on the first of the month. Well, what was happening was she'd pay it on the third week of the month, the prior month, and unfortunately, the bank reported her late because they didn't get that payment for that month. And what happened was it was a real mess because the bank reported it. Where's my payment for December? I didn't get one for December. You know, I got November 27th. They don't know what your intent is. And bottom line, and I believe computers certainly don't. And so if you make your payment before the first of the month, they're not showing you making that payment for that month. And then you've got a 30-day late on your mortgage, and then it goes to 60, then it goes to 90, then it goes to 120. Next thing you know, you're in deep, deep, deep trouble. So paying early on a mortgage is not good. You want to make sure you pay it between the first and the 15th. You can pay additional on the principal, as we were talking about earlier. But if you pay it before that, people don't understand or computers don't understand that what your intent is. So if you pay it early, you could potentially if it's reported incorrectly, really mess up your credit.
Okay, great program. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Now, there is one thing, and I guess I have to admit I never quite understood this, but I know that Dave and I have talked about this, that what you can do, some banks will let you do, is you take whatever your monthly payment is, and then you split that in half.
Correct.
And you pay half on the first of the month, mm-hmm. and you pay the other half on the 15th.
Biweekly.
Biweekly.
And you can have that. I'm sure that what they would like you to do is just have it an automatic, you know, withdrawal
they
sort of thing.
Sure,
where
they
okay.
do.
So you
bi-weekly.
Sign up for this thing, and mm-hmm. the bank takes half on the first and half on the 15th.
Correct.
And that's I know because you said, well, that's a good thing. I never quite understood what the advantage is. But so is that something you okay. might
sure.
want to think about doing?
Well, think about this. If you make a regular mortgage payment of $1,000
right.
All right. That's 12 mortgage payments a year or $12,000.
Right.
However, if you split that $1,000 into every 2 weeks, all right, and make a $500 payment every 2 weeks, well, you're actually making 26 payments, aren't you? Because there's 52 weeks in a year.
Okay.
So you understand?
Okay.
So now when we multiply 26 payments times $500, you're actually paying $13,000 a year, not $12,000 a year.
Okay,
understand
so,
it?
So okay, okay.
One extra payment.
You're
okay.
making a whole extra payment.
Okay.
Yeah. So what we were talking about earlier, you can do the same
and
thing.
Saying if you pay extra,
pay
on
extra
your
principal.
Correct.
Okay. And here's the one thing I want. There's a lot of people don't understand, and this is a good thing. I'm glad you asked this question. Is to set up a bi-weekly program like you were talking about,
yeah.
it costs money.
No question.
The
oh.
lender charges you
$400 to $500,
okay.
isn't it?
It depends what lender, but generally $200, $300, $400, $500
sure.
or so to set up the paperwork so that you – because now they have to deal with your paperwork for 26 times instead of 12. So they charge you a fee to set that up, and then you're effectively doing – you're effectively making an extra payment a year. Well, why spend $500 to send up something like that? Then you can do the same thing yourself by putting $42.50 a month
extra
on the
principal.
And it costs
okay.
you nothing to do that.
Okay.
And guess what? If next month you decide you don't want to do it because you're going on vacation,
you don't have to
do it. So a lot of people just automatically in their mind, instead of making a $450 payment, make a $500 payment. They don't think twice about it. Next thing you know, they're paid off 7 years early. So I heartily suggest doing that versus setting up a biweekly one.
Absolutely.
Because of the money, and you're accomplishing the same thing for nothing.
And remember, let's say that you have a $100,000 mortgage, David, and the interest rate is 6% and you have it over 30 years. You can play with that amortization schedule. You know what your balance is. You know what the interest rate is. You can go to a simple calculator or to a friend and say, gee, I want to amortize this over 23 years. 20 years, 18 years, and you can figure out what the payment needs to be to pay off that mortgage, and then that difference between your regular payment and that new payment is just additional principal that you put in
right.
each month. So you really control the payoff schedule
okay.
of any of these mortgages.
Well, we're at the point here we're going to have to stop for just this first hour. We will keep asking questions or keep taking questions next time. Dave will be with us. We want to say to our special guest here, Mark Jackowski, thanks very much. Again, he has for 18 years now been a mortgage consultant. He works with Wind Trust Mortgage in Champaign before that. He was a realtor for 17 years. Any last real quick thing you'd like to mention to folks?
I just want to let people know that Wind Trust was formerly Revere Mortgage. A lot of people don't know that. It just happened the last couple of months. But Revere Mortgage, I think a lot of people are familiar with. That's who I worked for until 2 months ago. But now we're Wintrust. So
all
just
right.
want to, you know, point
okay.
that out.
Well, thanks very much for being here. We appreciate it. And, Dave, thanks for hanging around here. We'll be back again.
We'll be back next hour.
In the next hour. Right